The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress-them-on-the-third-date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome, new listeners, to the Todd Glass Show. Before we get going, here's some stuff you should know. To tell if it's a bit or the truth from Todd, if he says potato salad or swear to God. Those expressions are comedic, little darling. If Todd means the truth, he always says to George Carlin. And on the topic of bits, let's erase any doubt. Todd's almost always joking when he says, edit it out. The intro goes long, cause Todd's so big-hearted. Other podcasts end before his gets started.
The intros are recorded on a phone, but don't worry, the audio of the show is at a higher quality.
You know, the Podcasters Association voted the Todd Glass Show a number one. So welcome to the show.
Well. You gotta fucking vote. I know, it's a pain in the ass. It's easy to say, maybe even lie and say you did. But I'm telling you, if you do it, you're gonna feel so fucking amazing. You feel better than you think you'd think you're gonna feel. You gotta fucking vote. You gotta vote. Steve Farnott's told me today, I hope he's right, only like, wait, he said a very low percentage of young people were voting. I forget the number. I know why. It's like you lose the momentum when something happens and you're like, yeah, but no, we're so close. Vote. I don't care who you vote for in this situation. Just vote. Vote. You feel like you ran the marathon. You're like, I fucking did it. There's a lot of shit you might not have done. I'm going to make this comparison. Like, you're going through sobriety. You might have difficulty with that even. This is something you can do. It's so doable and it's so fucking powerful. It's so fucking powerful. And it's relatively easy. I'll tell you what, it's not easy if you don't compare it to how powerful it is. It's a pain in the ass at the surface. It's like, oh, is it going to matter? Even though that seems so cliche to say that, is it going to matter? I think deep down, sometimes you think, do they need my vote? I've been there most of my life. I haven't voted. So I get it. I told people I voted when I didn't vote. Because I was embarrassed. But not any. This is not the fucking time. I'm telling you, for so many goddamn reasons, you'll do it. You're going to be so fucking proud of it. When you get in that car and you shut the door or wherever you go, that's what I did. And you're just going to feel amazing. And any of your other, hey, by the way, maybe you already, you don't have any shortcomings. Maybe you're overwhelmed, you're doing pretty good. We still got to fucking do it. But I'm just saying, if that's the case, it'll do good things. Plus, it's more than, it'll say more about you than just you voted. That's one thing, but it just says you did it. And if you get this done, you vote, you get it done, you'll get other shit done. You just said, I'm going to fucking do it. Excuse my language. But I know you're not going to get people to vote by just going, don't forget to vote, you know, it's then start rattling off things that are true, but, you know, it's the right, it's why we live in the United States. We got to go out there, people, your vote counts. That's not going to help anybody. You got to fucking get in their guts and get in their head. That's what I'm trying to do to you. Especially young people. Come on, I always got your back. Don't make me look bad. All right. Okay, so now the opening of the show. Well, here's what it is. We didn't have time to do a typical show this week, but we have a show for you. Oh, how is that? You know what I want to bring back on the show? Silly dancing. I know you can't see it, but God damn it, it's so much fun. I looked at old shows. Why am I cursing so much? A real potty mouth, huh? You're good? Okay. So, the week before last, Peter McGraw, watch, I'll say his name wrong. He wrote a book. Well, you'll hear it. We explain it in the show. But it's more of a traditional, just, you know, interview about his book and a comedy. Very intense conversation. Well, not very intense. Just a good conversation, a meaty conversation about comedy and some observations and all that crap. So, no, you know what I mean. Not all that crap. What if he's listening to the opening going, how dare he calls me? But we have a great conversation, and it says everything. It doesn't really need me to set anything up now. You'll learn anything you need to learn. So that's today's show. And next week, we'll be back in the barn. Oh, I'm really getting excited. I'm doing some new stuff in there, and it makes me look forward to it, to getting in there and, whew, you know, changing some things around. It's, you know, that's what... Sometimes exciting, you know. Oh, I'll move that chair over 3 inches. All right. How you doing? Ba, 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 ba. All right. So let's throw to the show. And next week will be a lot of fun. Okay? Go vote. Go vote!
It's a good show!
I'm impressed.
Thank you. Did I show this to you when we were back here before?
No, this is brand new.
Oh, I thought I did show it to you.
I had no idea.
Ah, then I would have brought you even bigger. I thought he's seen the studio before. So, so let me get settled here. Okay. We are recording, right? All right, cool. I'm going to put this over here. No matter how many weeks I do this, you would think I would know where I want everything, but it's not till I get in there. That's Vinny. That's my girlfriend's brother.
Yes.
There you go.
We met briefly, I think.
Right, right. And that's John you met inside. Aristotle's over there.
Hello.
And then we're going to do an after show once you're gone with Mike Carano. But so this is, and I even wrote some notes down, Peter. Sweet. I'm so professional. Well, I'm an interviewer, you know. I have to, and you can wear your headsets, but you don't have to.
Okay, maybe I'll give it a try. Right.
We sat down when you were still writing the book.
Yes.
And but I did your podcast.
Yes, and you made it into the book.
I did? Guys, come on. I'll get a nice round of applause. Come on. And I love talking to you. You had, you know, you just had some really clean perspective of comedy, which always calms me. And as much as I talk, which I know I went off, I still listen, and I liked a lot of the things that you said. And so now the book comes out on April 1st, right?
Yes.
And it's called The Shtick of...
It's called Shtick to Business.
Shtick to Business.
What the Masters of Comedy Can Teach You About Breaking Rules, Being Fearless, and Building a Serious Career.
And
there you go.
Thank you. And then, and you know, so did you interview Amy Poehler, or is it breaking down?
So some people I interviewed, and then some people I just based it off of observations of them, interviews of them, and so on.
Right. Because Vinny said, Groucho Marx, and I'm like, well, I know he didn't interview Groucho Marx.
No, but I did interview Groucho's assistant later in Groucho's life.
Really?
And how? Steve Stolliere.
And he, I don't know what my first question is. How old is he now? Is he, he's got to be.
Steve. God, I should be careful about this. He's certainly in his 50s. He might be in his 60s.
Wow. Groucho Marx's assistant.
Yeah, so Steve was a student at UCLA and somehow got hooked up. It's actually, I interviewed him for I'm Not Joking, my podcast.
Right.
He has a book called Raising Eyebrows about Groucho, and he gave me just tons of cool information about the Marx Brothers.
I mean, there's a guy that's history. Good comedy, I say, will withstand the generations. You still go back to that stuff, and it's
pretty solid today.
It's pretty solid,
yeah,
right?
It is.
It's amazing, and I like to watch that. I always like to go, wow, that's. Been watching Jonathan Winters lately.
Ah,
and are you familiar with Jonathan Winters?
Yeah.
And it's not like I didn't know he was great before, but you know how sometimes, yeah, I know he's great, but then you go, oh, I'm learning he was even greater.
So Steve has this great story that made it into the book about, you know, so one of the neat things about, so you think about the Marx Brothers and you think about their comedy, but you can also think about the way they approach their business as they move from vaudeville to Broadway and then to the big screen. And what was fascinating was their move to the big screen. When we look back on it, it seems sort of natural and they're just winners. Especially because, I don't know, there's some absurd number of their, I think like 5 of their comedies are in like the AFI top 100. You can't quote me on these numbers. With Duck Soup being the number one,
right,
you know, on the list. Well, when they were finishing up their contract of their first 5 films, they basically were getting dropped by their studio. Like their films didn't perform that well. And so they were contemplating going back to Broadway, where audiences love them. And, man, I should know all these things because I wrote it. But Chico,
you're getting the gist.
You're getting the gist of it.
Yeah, and more than that. You miss a detail here, and it doesn't affect the takeaway for the story. Right?
And so it was like the head of Paramount or something like this was playing cards with Chico, and he said to him, I can make a film with you that gets half as many laughs and makes twice as much money. And the idea was that the Marx Brothers were so used to performing live that they knew to pause when they hit a punchline because they were getting feedback in the moment. But their early films was like bam, 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 joke, 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 and audiences in the theaters would be laughing over subsequent jokes and in some ways didn't quite get to enjoy the film
right,
as much.
Right. And who pointed that out?
This was like the head of like a competing studio and then signed them for 5 more films.
And you said something that I don't want to forget to but ask you the one question I thought. Just want to establish, obviously, you know, the book and the purpose of the book and all that, because I love talking about comedy. I love that you're here. You were saying like that we just sort of watch their career like, oh, it just unfolded, like we probably do to a lot of people. And that's what you meant, like to us from afar. And I was obviously not around then to watch their comedy, but I knew what you meant. Like you just see, oh, they went from that, then the story is, then they did movies, and then they went to Broadway. But it really didn't unfold that easily.
It takes a lot of work. I think this happens a lot. I think it happens a lot in the world of science and art and literature and so on. When you look back, you know, we tend to, you know, we like to use this term Renaissance person, you know. But when you look at careers are often really linear. Someone works on something, masters it, then moves on to the next thing, masters it. You know, so I like Steve Martin as an example of this, right? You know, Steve Martin was one of the best stand-ups in the world, playing out arenas, and then, you know, moved into TV and film, and you know, recently won a Grammy for banjo playing.
Right.
But what he, you know, so you look back at someone's career and you just, oh, he's good at everything, but that's not how he, you know, that's not how he approached it. Even, you know, even the Marx Brothers, they weren't actually as good at film as they could have been. There's some learning process
right. That
happens there.
And so your first, you're obviously obsessed with comedy, because someone asked me the other day, we were talking about you coming in. I go, wonder, like, when did you, is that obsessed, not obsessed, but I mean, you break it down as much as I love to break it down. And a lot of comedians that I know, we sit around, it's, you know, it's fun to break down and try to figure out some things. And what made you, like, what was your background? What did you do?
Yeah,
like,
where
are you from?
Here?
Yeah, why are you, how'd you get here?
Yeah, I think, you know, I have a friend who, he describes me as a decoder. You know, so there's coders in the world and there's decoders. And so I guess I reluctantly accept that moniker from him. So, you know, I started my career kind of as a traditional academic, what I think lay people would call a behavioral economist. So studying emotions and decision making. So how do people's emotions affect their choices and how their choices affect their emotions. And I, you know, I liked comedy, and I wouldn't say I was a class clown by any means, but I kind of leaned that way a little bit, especially as I started to get older. But I wasn't obsessed with understanding comedy. I didn't actually think that much of it. I just enjoyed watching it, listening to it, and then being funny with my
intrigued
friends.
Intrigued would probably have been a better word.
Well, no, but it's become a bit of an obsession, I would say.
I knew it.
So I what happened was, and I think like the lesson in this is you often don't, it's often important to pay attention to things. So I was studying a question that's I think parallel, which is what makes things wrong? You know, why do we find some things to be morally reprehensible and then other things maybe just distasteful or confusing? And I was giving this talk, you know, academics will fly each other to their home university. So I got an invite from a colleague, and they fly you in, they put you in a hotel, they give you a delicious meal. And then you stand in front of a bunch of people presenting an early version of your work, and they basically shit on your ideas for about an hour. And it's an honor.
And how old are you at this point?
I am 38.
38, okay.
I'm 38 at this point. And then you get to put it on your vita that you visited this elite university, and it's considered prestigious.
Were there any positive people? Like, was there anybody?
No. Yeah. Well, I'm being hyperbolic, but it is really the case that academics sort of critique first, second, third, and fourth, and then fifth they compliment. That's just the way, this is the nature of the sort of scientific process. And so I was talking about religious marketing at the time, and this, you know, like, why is it that we might find it reprehensible for churches to use business principles? Even if their goal is to save souls, which you would assume to be a rather important thing for them. And in that talk I gave an entertaining example of a church in Tampa, Florida that was using a raffle to get people to go to their winter retreat. That seems okay, but they picked an unusual grand prize for the raffle, which was a yellow H2 Hummer SUV. And exactly, and I got like this, I didn't get like a full-on laugh, but I got people sort of chuckled at the idea. And I wanted them to chuckle at the idea. That's why I chose the example. You know, just because it's science doesn't mean we can't have fun. And someone raised their hand in the back of the room and asked me the most important question that's ever been asked to me, which is, you're making an argument that moral violations cause anger and disgust, and yet we're laughing. Why?
Ooh. Because of the, can I guess?
Of course, yeah, of course.
Because of the, like sometimes when I watch Dr. Phil, I know whatever you think of the show, you can still get what you need to get out of this. And the audience laughs, and the guest thinks, oh, you're laughing at me, your audience is laughing at me. He goes, they're not laughing at you, they're laughing at the absurdity.
Mm.
Is there anything?
Yeah, I think, well, so to me, absurdity is a special case of comedy, so to speak. And so, you know, I didn't have an answer in that moment. I had nothing. And I'm usually someone who can come up with something, you know. And I said, I don't know. And what I realized was I had never contemplated that question. Mm-hmm. So I had been studying emotions and decision making for 11 years at that point. I had considered myself an expert in that area. I had never read a paper about humor. I never contemplated what made people laugh, what caused amusement. And so when I flew back home to Boulder, Colorado, to the University of Colorado, where my home institution, I just couldn't shake the idea. And I made an appointment with one of my very bright graduate students who wanted to work with me, but we couldn't settle on something. And I said, we should write this paper, which is, why do people laugh at moral violations? And that quickly turned into...
Why do people laugh at what?
Moral violations.
Moral violations.
Things that are unethical.
Right.
And then that turned into a theory of humor, you know, dry esoteric papers about it that we're still publishing today, a part pop science, part memoir, part travelogue called The Humor Code, where we leave the lab to try to answer this question, and then here I am sitting with you,
right.
You know, talking about this kind of stuff.
Take us to this point now. We're then in you said April 1st, right? And that's when the other book came out, we were saying?
So my first book came out 6 years ago, April 1st.
And did you pick April 1st for any other day than just...
This is a PR stunt.
Right.
Yeah, of course. But so to answer your question, why, you know, what do we laugh at? What are we amused by? So we use this term benign violations. So things that are wrong yet okay, things that are threatening yet safe, things that don't make sense yet make sense. And when you start to apply that concept, you can start to explain a lot of the things that people find funny. You know, absurdity is an interesting one. I haven't actually run any studies on it, but I've always puzzled about absurdity and thought about it as it's this thing that there's clearly something wrong going on, but it almost doesn't feel real. Like, things that are absurd often have this unreal concept. So it almost feels imaginary. Like, I can't believe this is happening. You know, people say that.
Right.
Well, when something is not real, it removes the threat, right? Because things that are made up, that are fictitious, aren't truly threatening in the world.
And like, so like murderers versus goblins.
Yes, exactly. It's like bad horror films are funny.
Right, because there's... Right.
Because you can recognize... It's like they're not truly threatening.
Oh, you're something you said. You just said a minute ago, and I want... Oh, absurdity.
Yes.
Did I interrupt you?
No.
Absurdity. I always said absurdity, and I even try to explain this to some of my comedian friends who are having trouble with a joke not going over. I go, absurdity has to be earned. If you're sitting around the house and your friends know your hardcore views on an issue, you know, maybe they know, and then you say something absurd, it's because they know that you don't really feel that
way.
Yeah,
that's exactly.
So sometimes I think that's when a comedian tells a joke, and a friend of mine even, and he'll be like, yeah, I didn't get a laugh. I go, because they don't know whether you're saying that absurd or not. They don't know your stance on that issue. We would laugh in the living room if you said that, because we know you adamantly defy or back some, you know, some issue, and you're saying it in an absurd way. We know it's fucking absurd, but the audience doesn't, so that's not their fault.
You have to earn it.
You have to earn. If you say something to mock homophobia, they have to know you're not homophobic.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they don't know, wait, is this guy saying that? And I think you have to earn that. Like, what I used to have this joke in my act, and I didn't want them to think I was sexist. So I happened to really like Oprah at the time, and people would say, I made the Oprah joke defending Oprah. It was a joke about defending Oprah, but I got a laugh.
Okay.
But it was basically defending Oprah. And then later when I did that other joke, it worked, because they go, oh, well, this guy isn't, He obviously.
Yes.
So that's what I mean. Absurdity has to be earned, you know.
So the way I've always sort of thought about this, and you probably have dozens of examples of this as a professional comedian, is so if you take this benign violation framework and you think about it as two levers. I have a lever that makes something wrong, and I have a lever that makes things okay. And so the best jokes, you're pushing both of the levers fully. So it's really wrong, but it's also really okay. So, you know, you just alluded to one way that you make something okay. You know, you make an off-color risque joke about a woman, but the group already knows that you're a feminist, right? And that's the okay lever. And so it just so happens to be the case that there are an infinite number of ways to make something wrong, and there's an infinite number of ways to make them okay. And it just happens to be very difficult to be at the intersection of those things,
mm-hmm.
right? And so if it's just wrong, people are pissed at you. And if it's just okay, they're like, I came here to laugh, not yawn. And so you're looking for that sort of sweet spot.
Is the question who's to say what's right and wrong?
Well, so the audience is always, I think, the arbiter of that. So again, comedy is difficult, and that's really what led us to write the first book and to go out into the real world and tussle with these questions in real life. Like, yes, you need a lab to do the very controlled tests, but you need the real world to see it in all its glory,
right.
So to speak. Now, what is wrong and what is okay is determined by the location that you're at, right? If you're in a church or a comedy club, if you're in private or public, it is determined by the culture of the audience, by how many drinks you've had, what kind of mood you have, you already been laughing at stuff, you know. So all of these things start to have an effect, and then what good comics are doing is they're figuring out who's my audience, and I want to make them laugh, because you can't make everyone laugh. Like, the same joke that kills with one group dies with another. And then this is something that you and I have talked about, is how important getting the context right. You know, that that being in the right space and in the right mindset can have a huge effect.
Right. I always say history. Like, I watch the history of comedy and see what tends to still be, stands the test of time, and look at some common denominators between all the comedy that stands the test of time. And a lot of times, it's their social beliefs.
Okay.
Because when you punch down, it doesn't stand the test of time well, even a little down. In the present, all the stuff that they go, oh, come on, like, that's not... if I put punching down on a scale from 1 to 10, 10 being the worst,
mm-hmm.
yeah, even in the present, people go after the worst. But in history, even a 3 looks bad. Oh, my God.
It doesn't age well.
It doesn't age well.
No, it doesn't.
And it's not my wish on it. I always want to tell comedians and hug them and go, this isn't my wish on you. If you listen to me, you'll have a better career. Like, I'm telling you will thank me. It doesn't age well. And that's not a spell I've put on it. It's not my hoping with a potion. It doesn't age well all on its own.
I agree with that. We've talked about this on my podcast. Is like, it bothers me. It bothers me when middle-aged comedians make fun of young people. You know, it's just, also, by the way, those same middle-aged comedians were being made fun of when they were young people.
Right.
It's so it, and they didn't appreciate it. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yes. So I agree with you. You know, it is interesting thinking about what are the universals. I get that question a lot.
Universals of
comedy. Like, what is the thing that's universally funny? And the best answer I have is physical comedy, slapstick, because that has that harmless attack kind of element to it, right? So you know, comedy really evolved from tickling and play fighting, you know, from, you know, so you can, you know, apes and chimps and bonobos, monkeys and so on laugh. You know, they don't laugh the way we do, but it's essentially the same phenomenon. And when do they do it? They do it when they're play fighting, right? So from harmless attacks. And so you can, there's actually even research, there's this incredible YouTube video of this Washington State professor tickling rats. And so he like kind of, you can imagine sort of like, you know, if you flip them over and kind of rub their belly and all this kind of stuff. And rats are really social animals. And you can't hear anything with the human ear, but if you put this detector in there, you pick up these sort of ultrasonic chirps. And it's their indication that they're having fun. And it's so amazing because it's so crazy. And then what he'll do is he'll move his hand away from them to the other side of the cage. And the rats will chase the hand to try to engage with it. Well, that's like someone going, turning on Netflix to see your special. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. That, it's the same exact phenomenon, except they're the instead of a hand, it's your
right,
jokes.
Your words.
Yeah, exactly. It's incredible.
You think? I always think if I you know if I hear like somebody break down comedy,
mm-hmm.
That it helps me be a better comedian. That's why I think comedians, like, that's why I was interested to have you on the show, and that's why I just, you know, because it's not a technical business. I get it. Some people will go, it's not a technical business. You can't break. You can do both. You can be silly and break it down. You can break it down to help make you be a better comic and help you. Because a lot of the things that you said a few times, I don't even know if you realize it, but you were saying how the careers of these people took these weird turns, which means even back then there were new things happening in comedy and you either embraced it or you shit on it.
Yeah.
And got left in the wind.
I agree with that. It's innovation.
Right.
Right, so that's the thing is, if you were a comic and you ignored Twitter, you know, and if you're a comic and you ignore Instagram,
and then go back to Groucho Marx from the theater to people probably ignored TV. They went, oh Jesus, now you gotta do something set right.
Yes,
and so, it never worked for anybody that ignored it.
I think the issue is this: is if you want to grow and if you want to grow with audiences, then you need to be aware. So, there's this bit. It's not even a bit. So. I actually talk a lot, almost too much, about Jerry Seinfeld in this new book. In part because he is such, you know, he's such an observer. And then he just loves talking about comedy. He won't shut up about it. But he got interviewed about Seinfeld and about how it's become more popular as a result of syndication, reruns, and so on. And so he says, you know, this whatever, Channel 5 or whatever, you know, was kind of like the ratings were starting to go down. And so they're like, okay, we're not going to renew it. We're not going to keep renting, you know, Seinfeld. And they're like, okay, fine. And then another station, Channel 7, let's say, says, well, we're going to pick it up. And so what you would expect is, okay, so the ratings are going down on 5, then it moves over to 7. But the ratings don't stay there. They go up. And he's like, I have to understand this. Why is this happening? And his thing is, there are Channel 5 people and there are Channel 7 people, you know? And so you can't just expect people to find your comedy because, you know, there's Instagram people, there's Twitter people, there's comedy club people, there's Netflix people, there's Amazon, you know? And so to understand, yeah, I mean, this is called vaudeville theater, film, TV. These are just platforms that are technologically based. And so I think a lot of comedians don't give themselves enough either credit for being good business people or thinking that way, or they ought to. You know, they ought to be even better about approaching this craft because, as you know, it's so hard.
I learned as I get older that, like, there's certain guys that just understand the business of comedy, and they tend not to be the best comedians.
Mm, that's fair.
But just when they understand it, they don't have... But, I also know guys that are funny in their bones, but understand the business of comedy.
That's the deadly one-two punch.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly, like Jim Gaffigan. Jim Gaffigan is a funny fuck, but the fact that he understands and embraces whatever it is, whether it's Instagram or whether it's Twitter or whether it's when we're setting up, getting ready for a show, he turns on his phone and touch base with people. Here we are. Just mm-hmm. He does it effortlessly. He understands the business of comedy, and he is a funny person in his bones. You're right. Those are the people, and that's a compliment.
We're
both complimenting that, obviously. John Mulaney, I would say, is a guy. He's funny in his bones, but he also understands some. That's why I like to understand it myself. I didn't used to, but now I like to go, okay, what is this here? What will help me be a better comedian? Breaking it down for me does help.
Yeah, I don't claim that having a theory of humor is going to necessarily make someone funnier. My argument is that it might cut the learning curve, right? So imagine you're a new. So first of all, comics have been doing just fine without a theory of humor, and actually they have theories, and the theories are wrong, and they still seem to be doing okay, right? Right. So I'm not going to claim to have a magic bullet, but I think that we can both agree that having some. A little bit of either a business orientation or a scientific orientation, at least an empirical orientation, which is in this book, I talk about how vaudeville was the first lean startup. And
what does that mean?
So a lot of stand-up comedy really flows from what was happening in the world of vaudeville. And so what was happening in the world of vaudeville is the same thing that you do, which is, you have an idea for a joke. You have an intuition. Oh, this could be funny. You've written it out a little bit. But you don't really have any idea of how good or bad it is until you try it in front of a small audience. You never try a joke, a brand new joke, with one of your specials. By the time the special comes out, you know it works. Okay. And so so what is it that a lean startup does is it comes up with what they call an MVP, a minimum viable product. The argument is it can be embarrassingly bad, but what you want to do is put it out into the marketplace and then pay attention to how the market responds. What do people like? What do they not like? And then you make a decision, which is keep it, revise it, or dump it. And so most times that first time you tell a joke, it's not a keep it decision. It's either a revise it or dump it. And it's probably a revise it. And then you revise it, try again. Then you pay attention. And then you keep it, revise it, dump it. And you try it again. Keep it, revise it, dump it. And all the way, honing it. So then eventually it's this pristine joke that you tell in front of a large, large audience, in front of six cameras. And you're pretty sure it's going to land
right at
that point. And I think that the folks who, as you said, have funny in their bones, they have better instincts, they're better at the revisions, but the people who are really good at paying attention and charting these things, I talk to comics who have Excel spreadsheets, they're more like me than they are like Dave Chappelle.
Right.
And they,
I would split, I like to split the difference. Okay. I don't want to be...
You don't want to be me.
I don't want to be, just, I've learned that I can benefit doing what I do on stage, which is sort of just having my path, but also going off of it and just fucking have a random thought and going right and going left. But that doesn't mean that I can't make myself a much better comedian. And like I say, the more solid I get my beaten path. And that's if I choose to be a performer that can go out on the road and do well. And I do.
Mm-hmm.
I want to do well. I want to be the type of performer that I would want to go see. People spend hard-earned money, sometimes money they don't fucking even have or have the right to spend. So if I want to make people pay $25 to see a show, I want it to be a fucking great show.
Yes.
But I find the more I get the beaten path down, get that beaten path solid, you can go off of it. So creating a beaten path is in honor of going off the beaten path.
Indeed.
So that's why I like to figure out sometimes the science, hearing people, maybe like Jerry Seinfeld, that might be a little more pen and paper than me, but still go, you can do a little bit of that. You can get together with some comedian friends and help spice up some jokes you have, for a lack of a better word of saying it, you know? I've learned that more in the last 2 years than ever.
Why is that?
You know, there's a comedian in Philadelphia, and his name is Chip Chantry. And whenever I'm working in Philadelphia, I have a joke that I've been doing, and I'll be like, jokingly, on stage, he opened up the show, and I'll go, hey, Chip, write me three more of those. And he comes out the green room door 20 minutes later, and he gives me three more, and I read them. I'm like, he fucking took that.
That's great.
From sitting down and analyzing it and going, oh, well, we could go there with that. And then I do it again. I'm like, Chip, give me four more of those. And he knocks on the green room door. He comes out. So I went, oh, I can benefit by getting together with some comedian friends during the day and or reading a book. Or I won't read a book because I'm not good at reading. But I will, like, I want someone to read your book.
And then tell it to you.
Exactly.
I see.
Exactly.
I think I know a guy who could do that for you.
Who's that?
Well, it's one to my left and one to my right.
So that's why so that's why I enjoy hearing, like, comedy. You know, I like, because it's, because, you know, it helps you be sillier if you can understand the business of it. And the if there's a reason it's called
show business.
Yes.
I was too busy. I wanted to get a bell or something. There you go.
I do. So for me, what's interesting is no one really cared about my first book. I shouldn't say that. That's exaggeration. But the book didn't sell that well. It got, like, a lot of media attention, and it's been popular in comedy circles. But the average person doesn't really care that much about what makes things funny. Like, it's sort of a nice curiosity, and some people watch my TEDx video and so on. But it doesn't really solve a major problem for anyone. This is sad to say. You know, it's important for science, and it's a compelling question. It's an age-old question. But what prompted me to write Shtick to Business was, so my first thought was, well, if we can make people funnier, they're going to have a lot more positive outcomes in life, kind of thing. And then, like, the more I sort of studied that and the more I kind of started giving talks on that topic, I started to go, oh, no, we don't want to do this. Right? I don't want to go in front of 100 people or 1,000 people and tell them to go forth and be funnier, and especially at work. Right? You can imagine what happens, right? You know, because there's only, you know, let's be generous and say a third of people are well-skilled. Like, that's great for those third, you know?
Exactly. But you're, by the way, good for you for being aware of the fire you might start.
Oh, my God.
You're like, oh, no. No, I don't want to be. I don't
that guy. You got to worry about that guy, you know? And so then I had.
Wait, hold on. Can you ask you one?
Yeah, of course.
So I can relax. How, what time is it? There's never a great time to ask that, but I figure I'll ask now.
6:30.
Oh, great.
We're good on time.
Yeah, we're doing great. We're doing awesome.
Sure.
Okay, so go ahead.
And I don't know about your creative process, but I find that, you know, for me, there's sort of, and actually there's research that backs this up. So what is creativity? So creativity is an original, appropriate solution to a problem. Okay, so it's actually often pretty easy to find an appropriate solution. It's often difficult to find an original one. And so there are two paths to creativity. One is just persistence. Like, I'm just going to work on this idea. I'm going to work on this idea. I'm going to work on this idea. I'm going to come up with 100 ideas, and then one of them is bound to be creative. And then the other one is you allow yourself to work on an idea here and there, and you just recognize that there are multiple solutions, and you just kind of pay attention to your thoughts. And occasionally you have a thought and you go, there it is. And it feels like this bolt of lightning, but it's not. It's because you've been working on something, writing, thinking, letting it go, letting it come back, and so on. And so I'd always said, I'm never going to write another book. And I realized that I didn't want to do a talk about humor and leadership or something like that. And I got asked by this group at Google to give a talk to them. And I kind of pitched an idea, and they're like, well, we already have someone like that. And so they put down this constraint for me, which counterintuitively, constraints are, can be useful for creativity.
Right.
And then I said, well, I could give a talk about not what makes things funny and not about being funny, but what can we learn from the world's funniest people, from the masters of comedy. And suddenly this stuff was just pouring out of me from having, you know, having studied comedy, having spent time in green rooms, having done improv, having friends who were comedians, and having a life, you know, a lot of life experiences both in the lab and outside the lab. And I was like, oh, wow, these are, some of these ideas are really novel. You're not getting them in business books. You're not getting them in self-help books and so on. And so so that was where this came from. So I never, I like to say, I'll never ask you to tell a joke, you know, in the book, right? There's nothing about being funny, but it's about thinking funny. It's about thinking differently. And so you don't even, you have techniques, you have perspectives, you have practices that you use them automatically, and you might not even realize that you use them. Well, people can use those things, whether it be to start a new business or to try to develop their career.
There's more crossover than you think.
Exactly, yes.
And it always amazes me.
Yes.
How much crossover there is.
So I'll give you an example of this. So one of the things that I'd like to point out is how comedians take chances. So they sort of, first of all, they see the world differently. So Seinfeld calls them humanoids. You know, they're not aliens, but they're not humans. So they kind of, you know, so as a result, they ask why a lot. You know, they notice things that that other people don't really
and
notice.
As they age.
What do you mean?
Little kids ask why, but then you stop.
And then they stop.
But then a comedian or keeps artistic, asking. You could say. You could widen the past. But yes, they keep asking why. Which, you know.
And then the other thing that they do, and so when you have a different perspective on life, you start to notice opportunities that other people don't notice. You know, and that's really most entrepreneurial ventures come from an observation that, you know, that most people aren't having. And then the other thing is that comedians take chances. They're constantly breaking rules. They're constantly taking risks. The act of developing a joke is a series of chances. But then they also, because they don't play well in kind of normal organizational sort of settings, they're sort of always kind of a little bit of an outsider that's there. And so I think about, I really love what you're doing with your comedy, like having this band play with you. I think it's great. And in particular, because in the pursuit of comedy, novelty, creativity is paramount. You know, so you're not a musician. You know, the Rolling Stones can play their hits on tour. You have to give up jokes in order to create new jokes. And you're insert, you know, you called it, you said it, it's show business. You want to entertain people. And so people aren't having a band with them. Let's take a chance. Let's see how this goes. You know, the average person doesn't do that. And yet the average person probably would be better off doing more of
right.
that kind of thing.
You know, we were talking about this last night, and it has to do with specifically stand-up comedians. But up to this point, for the last 3 years, I've been doing it like I'm going to do it with you right now. And it is that somebody famous and successful said, if you're not working with stand-up comedians, you're wasting your time.
Mm.
Now, that doesn't mean that Brad Pitt shouldn't have a career or, you know, whoever it is. But what it means is that comedians tend to get shit done. Mm. And I'm proud of that. But isn't it sort of alluding to what you're saying, that there must be something, and it's I guess it's a moment of feeling proud instead of me taking, I'm not taking the glory, but proud of comedians. Like, why is it true?
I think that, yes. So I think the thing is, there's a tendency to, you know, to look at comedians, they're kind of misfits, you know, and they wear cargo shorts on stage and they drink too much. And you know what I mean? Like, there's this sort of, they're outsiders and they misbehave and you think, okay, well, they tell jokes and that's good, but a little frivolous. But my argument is, I mean, look, I'm starting a consulting agency where I'm like, I'll bring comedians into your business to help you solve problems because A, they're whip smart.
Right.
B, they have a way to see the world.
Well, I know
world.
That sounds disgusting. I just go right. Ugh.
No, no, no. But, look, I can tell you this. The research is clear. When the best predictor.
Right. Oh, you're telling him exactly. But go ahead. Go ahead. I know I'm okay with saying it, but I have to preface the absurdity of it.
The research
bring into
is
your
clear.
Business because.
Yes, exactly. Like, you look, I'm not sure you want to hire a comedian to work for you full time, but when you have a particular problem. And you want a different perspective. So I'll get so this guy, this like engineer at MIT did his doctoral thesis on looking at like improvisers. And he pit improvisers against product designers to in a task to figure who could come up with more creative ideas. The improvisers won. Right? So
it's not even their thing. They're
not
thing
even
is improvising, but
they were like 25% better than these product designers.
And when you say improvisers in what capacity?
You know, I'd have to go back and read the doctoral thesis, but these were, I think, like, you know, you can imagine like advanced.
Matt Besser, no.
No, no. These are advanced improvisers. So these are people who are good at what they do.
Well,
but so
maybe, the, yeah, Matt Besser.
Yeah, well, I think it was probably Boston folks.
Okay, you know. Okay. I know not him, but yes. But that's what you mean. When you mean improvisers, I wasn't sure. Like, do you mean like guys that...
I think advanced improvisers in this study.
Like guys that are... Okay. So, yeah. So, and then they did better than people...
Than the product designers. Yeah.
And why do you think that is?
I think in general... You know, when you do comedy, you know, you recognize how persistence matters. And then, you know, with years and years of doing this, you just get wired in such a way to think what we call divergently. So there's two forms of thinking. Convergent thinking is to figure out that one solution, 2 + 2 = 4. But divergent thinking recognizes that there are multiple solutions.
And which is usually probably the case, right?
For almost anything of importance, right? Because you don't need humans for convergent thinking, right? That's the job that robots are going to take. AI is going to take those jobs, you know, because that's why like AI does well on standardized tests. The kind of work that's going to become increasingly important is work that requires divergent thinking, creative thinking, because that's work that's not rule-based. And so robots do rules well, comedians break rules well. And that's, you know, that's where innovation comes from breaking rules.
I love it. Did you blow your nose? I told him we'd make a bit out of it. I go, just blow your nose at the table and like move away from the mic and then we'll all be like, we'd all go, oh, so disgusting, so rude. I go, that way you don't have to get up and down. But I like, oh yeah, you're the man. I'm curious if from afar or from the way you're looking at things, someone like specifically, hold on, I wrote it down, not Amy, oh, Tina Fey.
Tina Fey.
Like,
yeah.
I love looking at Tina Fey's career.
Mm.
And I am in awe of it. I'm in awe of it. I would imagine you're a Tina Fey fan as well.
I am.
Yeah. Can you look at her career and sort of like,
And dissect her, yeah, where her success comes from.
Yeah, like except for having fun in her bones, but we're given that. We're that's a given. No one's trying to think that you could scientifically make someone funny. You're not. I'm not. Nobody that knows anything about comedy is. But we're talking about the other end of comedy.
Yes.
So, because the boundaries. I just love for years. Every time. Well, here's the women can't do this and women can't do that. And I love to watch women just plow past all that shit with a snowplow and just go, yeah, we can pretty much do anything we fucking want. You know
Indeed.
What I mean?
Yes. I mean, like the idea that your genitals have anything to do with your abilities in comedy makes no sense to me at all.
Makes no sense, right.
Yeah.
Especially in an artistic world. We're supposed to move past that, you know?
Yeah, indeed. So, you know, to me the thing... So Tina Fey comes up in the book just briefly, but I can say more about it. So in it, she actually talks about... So one thing that I think is fascinating about Tina Fey, and I think this is the case with a lot of comics, is they pay attention. They see how other people do things, and then they replicate the stuff that works, and then they let go of the stuff that doesn't work. So in Bossy Pants, she talks about Lorne Michaels and how he builds a writer's room. And so in the Saturday Night Live writer's room, he sort of has these two different groups of people that he brings together, the kind of heady Harvard Lampoon types who tend to be kind of really good joke writers, and then the more Chicago style, sort of more blue collar kind of types. And the idea is that the best writer's room has a mix of those two together, that they complement each other. If it's too heady and too joke writey, it doesn't work. If it's too blue collar, you know, you don't have you don't have the stuff. And so,
same thing with stand-up.
Like there's this so, you know, well, what happens? So Tina Fey has the writing chops, no doubt, and then she also has the performance skills, right? So she has both, you know, what you need during the day in order to work on material, and then what you need at night to be able to sort of perform it. But you know, where's Tina Fey's, I think, real legacy is in 30 Rock especially. But even like Mean Girls, you know, like what an outstanding comedy film.
Right. I agree.
I watched that for the first time. I was like 42 years old and I was like, damn, this movie is good. And it's good because it's so well written.
Like 30 Rock.
30 Rock is so well written. And then when you think about that kind of complementation, you know, you have Alec Baldwin oh my goodness! What a Tracy Morgan. Tracy Morgan, right? You know, that show does not work nearly as well if you omit one of those folks.
Right.
And so you know, you imagine like the three of them in a room, that scene just pops. It's great.
Sometimes I watch that show. I go, you know what? You know what I know about the worst? I say this about a few shows, but it's definitely appropriate for a. For 30 Rock, the worst show they ever fucking did is fucking great.
Yeah, it's really.
They don't know that.
It's really cool how they actually like. They're very meta. They talked about why they brought on Tracy Morgan, being like it's a different element they needed to the show that's in the show, but then talking about it, they explained it in the show that you're watching.
Is that right?
Yeah.
It's great.
He's the third heat or whatever.
Yeah, That's like for me TV I know I can turn on and within 10 seconds I'm going to be laughing. It's just comfort television. It's like mashed potatoes with brown gravy. Oh, as soon as I flip by it on the television, and same thing, not to open up a can of worms, even though Seinfeld lately his opinions I adamantly, but the show, I know. And that's how good that fucking show is.
Well, so I, you know, I go a bit into why that show's so good. So there's two things. Well, I think there's kind of like there's three things that help make Seinfeld so good. So one is Larry David. And so, you know, so I talk about this idea of we want to kind of have the lone genius. You know, we want to.
Can I borrow your
pen? Please.
Because I want to hear what you're saying, but I don't want to forget to bring this up when you're done. But I don't want to just be repeating it in my head. What was the thing you just said about Larry David. Oh, okay. There genius. We go. Now I can listen to you, but remember what I want to talk about. So, go ahead.
When you look at, first of all, when you look at comedy, we often want to bestow someone as a comic genius, and I think that's fair, especially you know, from a creative standpoint. But when it comes to making something, so making a special, making a show, or anything. You start to very quickly realize that genius needs lots and lots of other people, right? So, I interview Meryl Marco for the book. So Meryl Marco, most people don't know this, but she was sort of the gal behind the guy. So she was a producer and writer for Letterman for many, many years.
Right. That was Letterman's
late night. What's that?
Was she?
They dated a bit, but
and she came up with like she had a lot to do with.
She invented stupid pet tricks. She was the one who guided him into the man on the street interviews because he wasn't a very good actor. She wrote jokes for him at the Comedy Store back in the day.
Right, and not that this is even relevant right now, but I'm so is Mar- how is she doing now?
She's great. She lives out in Malibu. I visited her. She's like,
good. And Letterman definitely credits her, right? or not.
Yeah,
enough.
I think anybody in the know knows.
That
I like to say there is no Late Night with David Letterman without Meryl Marco. There is no Chappelle Show without Neil Brennan. There is no Seinfeld without Larry David. Like, you need oftentimes that person behind the scenes that are, they're alike enough that they get along and they share a lot, but they're different enough that they bring things to the table.
I totally agree with you.
Okay.
And I wouldn't just jam this in there to take a jab at Jerry Seinfeld. But look, he's not dead. He's a young guy when it comes to comedy. I may pretend everything I say, that what if the person I was critiquing heard it?
Okay.
And I try to say it in a way that they'd be able to take it in.
Okay.
And amongst a few things that Jerry has said over the last few years that bother me, I have an immense respect for Jerry Seinfeld. I love the show. I love him. I love his respect for comedy. I love that he treats comedy with respect and dignity. But lately, it doesn't mean that. And the thing that bothers me,
okay,
Jerry Seinfeld is famous for saying, why can't you be normal to do comedy? Now, when I say you have to be a little abnormal to do it, it doesn't mean I have to be addicted to heroin,
sure,
or have some. But you beat to a different drum. And to me, the problem with Jerry lately that bothers me, and I wish he was a little more self-aware, that if he would say, you know, I don't. What are you going to therapy for? When he, you know, with Gary Shandling, or the mocking any self, you know, self-analyzation or therapy or, you know, growing, and is that if he was somewhat self-aware, it's okay to say it, but he would catch himself and go, you know, well, you know, because you know what I'm talking about a little bit, right?
A
Shandling, it's always like, oh, what do you start? What do you have to? What do you? But if he was self-aware, he'd say it and take a pause and go, but then again, maybe I should shut up. Larry David had his handprint all over my show, and he tends to beat to a different drum. So maybe I should shut the fuck up.
I see.
I'm saying, not me saying that, about him saying about himself and going, yeah, maybe my legacy won't be my stand-up. It'll be my show, which was had so much depth. It was simple, but it was difficult. And that's my problem, because it's sort of what you're saying as far as bringing in Tracy Morgan and into that situation.
Yes.
And that I wish Jerry was self-aware enough to go, you know I always give that big speech about how normal you can be, but maybe I should and realize the imprint of abnormal on my show is what will make it stand the test of time, that it had depth.
Yeah, that's fascinating. You know, so one of the things that he did with that show that I like a lot. So in one of the chapters in the book, I call it Work Hard or Hardly Work. And so I think that comics are great at this. You know, they're good about doing their writing. They're good about being at open mics, but then they're also good about being bored. Like, they're good at, like, letting themselves get away and have fun and so on. And so in that chapter, I talk about protecting your time. So you want to protect your time so that you can work on your creative work. And this is, like, if you work in a corporate environment, if you're a founder of a company, if you're an academic, if you're a comic, you need sacred time to do your most important work, your most rewarding professional work. So Seinfeld and Larry David had this. So when they knew that when the most important part of the show was the script. And so when they were finalizing a script, they would go into the office and they would close and lock the door, and no one was allowed to interrupt them. The only person who interacted with them was the secretary. So they would bring out these, you know, written these pages of notes with all these notes on there, and then she would type it up. And every so often she would crack up laughing at something that was in the script, and they would like burst out of the office and ask her what she was laughing at. That was their only interruption. So they would protect their time.
And that's so, Larry David and Jerry.
Jerry, those
in
two.
In the room.
In the room, that's it. And so there was no questions about costume, set design, you know, whatever it was, because they knew that 80% came from that 20%, that's
right.
So the other thing I talk about is the grind, this idea that you need to work on your craft every day, you know, that it's like it's a regimented thing. You know, you can't cram 14 hours of work and expect the same effect of doing 2 hours a day for 7 days. And so Jerry talks about this when he's preparing a stand-up special. He says, don't break the chain. You know, he has this big desk calendar, he makes an X when he works on his material, the next day an X. After 3 days, there's three X's, there's a chain, and his thing is keep working on it a little bit at least every single day. The third thing is, so there's protect, there's grind, and then release, to let yourself step away from this work in order to recharge and refresh and spend time with people you care about, get some sun, get some exercise, get some rest. So, you know, Jerry has been meditating since the 70s. And he would meditate.
So he is spiritual in that sense.
Yeah, he recognizes that even the most calm person needs to be able to calm themselves even further. And he credits being able to work on that show, because it's incredibly tiring, challenging thing to do. And you can imagine being not only, you know, one of the lead writers, but also the star of the show and everything else that comes along with it. And so, you know, you have a tendency to just go, oh, that person's a comic genius. And then when you pull the curtain back, so to speak, you start going, oh, wow, they have practices that allow them to maximize their craft.
Right. Yeah. Guess what, Peter?
Yes, sir.
We got to go to close.
All right.
But guess what? I think I'll see how I'm good at wrapping things up. For the last 2 years on this show, I've been quoting that comedians, you know. But I have a feeling that wrapping that up and figuring that out, which I will put in there who it was.
Okay.
But also the book will help even explain that further. Because like you said, like, you'd be surprised how much crossover there is. For comedians to read the book, of course, because I love talking about comedy. But for a teacher or anybody,
they have no idea what happens behind the scenes.
No, and to take that and think, you could take that. Why that person, which we now know who it is, we don't in this room, but the audience knows because I said it, to why that person said that, and then you can apply it, the business end of comedy, to something that you do is, I think, a really positive thing. So I'm saying, go fucking buy the book.
Amazon.
And if there's any business end of it, now's the time. Like, make it easy for people that are listening to the show that go, yeah, I want to go get it. And that way, I'll repeat it up front, but I'll hear you say it here. So it's Amazon.
Sure, yeah. So the book launches on April 1st, on April Fool's Day. Mm-hmm. And the best place to get it is on Amazon, whether it be Audible, an ebook, or the soft cover.
And what is your podcast called?
So my podcast is called I'm Not Joking, mm-hmm. and it's a look at the lives of funny people.
Wow. That was good. That was intense. You feel heard?
That's great.
Is there anything I didn't ask you?
No. You know, this is my first, like, interview about the book. So I got to get used to, you know, my hitting my major points.
Well, there we go. So thank you. How do we ride out? Can we ride out with a song? What's a good song? How about How about comedy? Something familiar. So thank you very much.
Yeah, sure.
That was fun. And April 1st, we'll give it another plug when that comes around.
That'd be great.
On this show, we'll give it a plug. And my listeners, blah 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 blah. We'll be back. Why don't we ride out with?
Want to play Andy Frasco's new single?
Yeah. There we go. So there we go. We put your name up there, Peter McGraw, ladies and gentlemen. And we'll ride out with Andy Frasco. Thank you so much. That was a lot of fun. I loved it. There we go. You hear the music? Is it coming in?
I gotta find myself. It's you I like. It's not the things you wear, not the way you do your hair, but it's you I like. The way you are right now, the way down deep inside you, not the things that hide you, not your toys, they're just beside you. But it's you I like. Every part of you, your skin, your eyes, your feelings, whether old or new. And I hope that you'll remember, even when you're feeling blue, that it's you I like. It's you yourself. It's you. It's you. It's you I like. It's you I
Star Bands Audio, a podcast network.